right now, both the Federal Reserve and the RBA are having a confidence game with the financial markets. If the financial markets actually believed that inflation was going to stay at 8%, then interest rates wouldn't be 3.3% as they are now, 3.35%.
This is the Reserve Bank cash rate, as they call it.
Yeah, the Reserve Bank cash rate.
Mm-hmm.
They would be every bit as high as inflation is. So with 8% inflation, the market would be charging 8% plus interest rates. So right now, the Fed and the RBA are doing a confidence trick on the market, and that is that inflation is going to come down really rapidly as we go through this year and the year after. And it's only because of that that they can get away with an interest rate of 3% instead of an interest rate of 6%. If the market stops believing or stops having confidence in the ability of the RBA and the Federal Reserve to reduce inflation, to knock it right down to where they say it's going to be, back to 2% in a couple of years' time,
mm-hmm.
Then there's going to be not quite hell to pay, but a vastly larger amount to pay in financial markets between now and that 2 years' time.
There are apparently two ways to sort of deal with this normally. One's called monetary policy, another one's called fiscal.
Yeah.
I want to start with monetary policy because Philip Lowe was asked about that this morning in his day one of his appearance. I'll play you the question and answer and get you to be an interpreter for me to explain it.
Could I first ask whether you believe current monetary policy settings are expansionary, contractionary or neutral?
As things currently stand, monetary policy is restrictive. You see that in
contractionary.
It's restricting. You see that in the fact that housing prices are falling, the rate of home building has slowed down, and people are having to pay a lot more on their mortgages. Those things are all contracting or restricting growth in the economy. So monetary policy is restrictive.
So what's he saying? Interpret that for me, Michael Knox.
Well, that monetary policy is interest rates are high enough to reduce demand for things like houses. And as demand comes down, then after a lag, inflation will come down. That's where he's going with that. And we're just at the point where interest rates are high enough to do that. I don't think that interest rates are restrictive enough, you know, in comparisons to previous cycles. And I think they're going to have to go significantly higher.
So you're one of those who says there'll be two more interest rate rises at least.
At least. And the comparison that I make is that Australia right now is having a big export surplus. We've got a big commodities boom. Last time we had a big commodities boom, interest rates peaked at a number of 4.75%. That's still 1.5% higher than we currently are. So, and historically, when we've had these big commodity booms, you've needed to have very tight monetary policy to slow down inflation. That's what I believe he is going to have to continue to do.
There's another thing that you can do. So monetary policy is what the Reserve Bank does with their cash rate. The argument is that the government could do something.
Sure.
I believe encapsulated as fiscal policy. He was asked about this straight after.
In the Reserve Bank's opinion, is the current fiscal policy expansionary, restrictive or neutral?
Our assessment is that it's broadly neutral. If you take the federal government and the state governments together, which I think is the best way to think about it, the budget deficit's a share of GDP around 3%, and it's likely to stay around that mark for the next few years. The federal budget deficit narrows a bit and then widens, and the states are doing the reverse. So the best way to think about whether fiscal policy is contractionary or expansionary is to look at the change in the aggregate budget deficit. And over the forecast period, there's little change in the budget deficit as a share of GDP. So I would describe it as neutral.
Let me leave it there. What's he referring to? What are the implications of this, Michael Knox?
Well, he says that fiscal policy is neutral.
So the federal government's not doing anything significant, really, to either ease interest rates or lift interest rates.
He's talking about the general government sector. He's talking about the combination of the federal government and state governments. Now, some state governments, like Victoria, are having significant deficits, but the Australian government will probably have a surplus this year. If you balance that out, that's the general government sector is about balanced, and therefore it's about neutral. That's what he's saying. But historically, if I might just sort of...
Please do.
Provide a bit of background.
I love your history lessons.
Okay. So last month, January anyway, I went to a series of presentations by leading economists in the United States, which I try and do every year. And there was two presentations that were significant, or many presentations were significant, but the two were Larry Summers. Now, Larry Summers and Ken Rogoff. Now, Larry Summers was a Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration. And after that, he became president of Harvard. I mean, what could he possibly know, this guy? You know? And the other guy was Ken Rogoff. And Ken Rogoff was a chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, who then wrote the book about 700 years of financial crisis called This Time It's Different, with Carmen Reinhart. Both of these are, you know...
They're smart people.
Yeah, they're smart people, and they know stuff about economics. Now, both of them said that we've been through a period like with really, really big budget deficits in the US, as big as World War II, okay? And I would argue, and I will if you like later on, how those budget deficits created the current inflation problem, okay? I can do that. But what they say is that just like after World War II, you're moving into a period where employment, the population growth of working-age people is less than it was. And that's very much like the period after World War II. So the rate of growth of millennials coming into the workforce was less than the rate of growth of baby boomers coming into the workforce.
Young people aren't having children.
Young people aren't having children, but even the baby boomers had fewer children.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that means that unemployment is going to be lower, okay, for an extended period of time because there's fewer people coming into the workforce. Simple. Reduce the supply of labour, unemployment goes down. But they both said that the result of that is that real interest rates compared to inflation are going to be higher as they were after World War II. And that's one of the things that controls inflation and did control inflation after World War II. We had relatively low inflation for the next 20 years.
Yep.
Well, firstly, we had a big burst of inflation directly after World War II, pretty much like we're having now after that big deficit spending of World War II. And then we settled down to having these relatively higher interest rates, but also... in Australia in particular, budget surpluses. So Australia, in the period after World War II, from about 1950 to 1972, had an average budget surplus of, in modern terms, about 2% of GDP. Okay? And that kept interest rates low and unemployment was very low. Okay? But it was the combination of that that long-term budget surplus of about 2% of GDP in modern terms that allowed us to pay back the debt from World War II and keep inflation relatively low and keep interest rates relatively low. Now, this brings us back to the question of how did we get this inflation to begin with?
How did we get here today?
How did we get to this inflation? And Larry Summers is the first guy who and told us about what was happening at the time, and this is in 2021. And he found great fault with what was then called the spending program of the Biden administration, which had just come in, called the American Rescue Plan. And what was happening was that there had been already enormously big budget deficit of 16% of GDP the previous year. And that had caused there was already a major rebound happening in the US economy. And that had taken up all of the slack resources in the US economy. So that was the amount of the budget deficit. The previous year was 16% of GDP, which was the highest since about 1943. It wasn't as high as 1944 and 1945, but in the entire period that they've had national accounts for the US, they were the highest apart from those 2 years in World War II, okay? Mm-hmm. That's why this World War II thing is similar. In the 16% of GDP year, there was still about, when they spent that, the deficit was that size. The gap in the economy was close to 12% of GDP because of shutdown. And there had been very rapid growth. But in 2021, that gap in GDP, the amount of resources that was still available to grow the economy was only about 1% of GDP. And yet what happened was they added what was 0.95% of GDP in the middle of the year. But the American Rescue Plan added another deficit of 11.9% of demand in a situation where there was only 0.9% of supply. So as you can see from you, if you take 0.9% away from 11.9, that adds 11% directly to inflation, and that's fiscal inflation. There's a long discussion of this in a book by John Cochrane, who is an Anderson Senior Fellow at Stanford University, called The Fiscal Theory of the Price Level, in which he explains in detail how all this happens. But that's where the inflation came from. Larry Summers, who was a Democrat and lifetime Democrat, member of the Clinton administration, identified it at the time. That's where this inflation came from. Too much spending, too big a budget deficit as Biden came into office.
Too much spending has created an inflation problem for us.
Yeah, and a worldwide inflation problem, which had nothing to do with us. We didn't start it. The Europeans didn't start it. The British didn't start it. The Americans started it. So, hey, you know, that's become the international problem we now all face.
As Billy Joel once sung, we didn't start the fire. So,
no.
All right, well, let me bring you back to Philip Lowe and today. The reason why there's such attention on the Reserve Bank of Australia and Philip Lowe today is that because of these inflation pressures, the cash rate of the RBA is going up, and you and other economists say there's going to be more.
Yes.
But a lot of people, for the last couple of years, apparently believed Philip Lowe's prediction that interest rates wouldn't rise until 2024. So for good or for ill, they signed onto mortgages, bought houses at the peak of the market, bought mortgages when money was really cheap, and now the money is getting more expensive. And everyone's pointing the finger of blame at poor old Philip Lowe, saying, you did this. My understanding is that's not entirely fair, because the cheap money was at emergency low levels to save the global economy, that the interest rates now are actually just going back to what they would normally be in ordinary times. What's your take, Michael Knox?
Well, we need to go up a bit more to get to where we normally would be. In normal times, what we experienced, if in terms of the long-term US data, was back in 1789, Alexander Hamilton, the guy in the musical.
Currently on a QPAC.
Currently on a QPAC. He invented the US Treasury bond, okay? 1789.
Okay.
It got passed by 2 votes in the floor of Congress, which the building and the room is still preserved in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's called Liberty Park, something like that. And I've stood there on that floor, you know, as a tourist. So in all of that time, since 1789, the lowest interest rates in that entire period were in 2020, you know, half of 1% for the US GDP. It's in all of those hundreds of years, 200 and some years, yeah.
Record low, extraordinarily low, historically low. All the superlatives, they're all, you can't beat it.
The lowest in many, many since before Australia was first settled. Okay.
Yep. Before Federation, before settlement.
Before
white settlement.
Yeah, before Captain Phillip lobbed up on the beach. You know?
Okay.
that guy, you know. And now interest rates had to increase from that level. I mean, there was only one chance in about 230 that they weren't, and they have, and now they're going up to a normal level. So, you know, a 5%, say, long-term interest rate, if I look at the average long-term interest rate in Australia for the last 40 years, it's come to like 7%. The average long-term US interest rate in the last 40 years is something like 5.2%, something like that. That's actually where the long-term normal kind of interest rates are. The short rate is a little bit lower than that, but not much. Like I say, like last time we had a commodities boom like we have now, smaller one than we had now.
Mm-hmm.
Interest rates went up to, in Australia, the Australian cash rate went up to 4.75%. So in comparison to history, interest rates are still low.
Is it fair to blame Philip Lowe for this? At the moment, the Reserve Bank is being reviewed by, you know, a review order by Jim Chalmers. He'll have the report in his hand very soon, I imagine. And the discussion is whether the Reserve Bank board is made up of the right people. In other words, is there an ordinary John or Mary citizen who has to pay mortgages, feed kids, you know, go shopping at the supermarket every week? And should there be someone like that, like a Bill Keltie type, I guess, who was on the RBA board when Hawke was Prime Minister? In other words, is the board makeup getting the right data, which is partly what this two-day grilling of Philip Lowe is going to be about?
I think I've been in this business a long time. I've been in the economics business a long time, and I've always believed that economists exist to make weather forecasters look good. and I think it's wonderful that people put their faith in an economist and his forecast, and I think now we've learned the folly for all, again. Of doing such things, and I think that was the best information he had available. As I recall, they were facing another series of where is the next variant of COVID coming from, and how much damage will it be, and will it be worse?
Because they had sort of had two phases of the pandemic, which were economic shocks and then a war,
yes,
and all this pent-up inflation because of the quantitative easing that's been taking place for the last, since 2008. So they a very difficult thing to untangle.
Well, as I say, I think it's mainly caused by the size of the US budget deficit, yep, this beginning of,
yep,
of the Biden administration. But there was a situation of great crisis, and it wasn't apparent that the world economy was going to recover from it. Mm. I mean, the go-to strategy at the time was shutdown, and every time we'd have another variant, would there be another shutdown? China, who invented the shutdown, was still doing this up until about a month ago.
Yep.
The world economy could have gone on like that if it hadn't been for the rushed program, the rapid program of getting vaccines from the US, the world would still be in that situation. Who knew that that was going to work? So, you know, as well as it has.
This is ABC Radio Brisbane. My guest is Michael Knox, economist from Morgans. We're talking about Philip Lowe, the Reserve Bank, and interest rates. Philip Lowe is appearing today and tomorrow before the Senate Economics Committee. He was asked about aggregate demand. I'm going to play what he said and then ask you, what is aggregate demand and what are the implications for you and me as we pay off our mortgage and deal with interest rates?
At the moment, aggregate demand growth has been too strong, and interest rates are part of the way that we bring that back down again. Interest rates are a nimble policy tool. They're a blunt policy tool, but they're nimble. Mm. The Reserve Bank Board meets every month, and we can take decisions every month based on the flow of information. The received wisdom over recent time is that fiscal policy, most of the time, is it not as effective as managing the cycle. Mm-hmm. Because if you're going to have fiscal measures introduced, it has to go through the House of Representatives, the Senate, and it's, you know, that takes time. So I was broadly ascribed to this view that fiscal policy most of the time should be dealing with the structural issues and the structural budget position. And except for in extraordinary times, it's not the best tool to use to manage aggregate demand. Interest rates, for all the faults and all the problems we have, is the more nimble tool.
Please explain. Aggregate demand, he's saying that things are too hot and interest rates are the best way of dealing with this, which is your point. Interest rates are going to go up still further yet, and they should.
Well, aggregate demand is all of the money we spend. You know, we've had very strong retail sales. Mm-hmm. And it's only now that those retail sales are starting to roll over a bit in Australia. And that's in response to interest rates going up. So it's the number of people in jobs and the total of all the money that they've got, plus their savings, and how much of that they spend. Well, right now we've got fantastic employment in the Australian economy, the lowest unemployment in your and my working lifetimes.
Yes.
And
yeah, people forget that. Yes.
Yeah. And that means there's a lot of people out there making money and spending money. And in addition, there's the handouts that people got during the shutdowns that, you know, has allowed them to repay some of their debt. And a lot of that money went into repaying mortgages, for example. Mm-hmm. And they've got that, you know, as an extra buffer. And that allows them to spend more money now. So all of that is aggregate demand. And then he's moving up interest rates to reduce that level of spending. And what he expects to happen and what the RBA and its forecasts have suggested is that unemployment will start to, growth will slow to a point where it's growing more slowly than people coming into the workforce, and unemployment will go up. And unemployment will go up from 3.5% over the next years to 4.5%. It was really interesting. I was reading an article saying, "Well, if they know it's going to go up to 4.5%, they should stop putting up interest rates." And I thought, 4.5% interest rates for the previous 5 years that I've been like whenever I've been talking to people at the RBA, it's kind of a dreamed of low level that you could possibly get unemployment down to, and they've never been able to do it before. And suddenly they find themselves with 3.5%, really because of all the stimulus that's been, the increase in aggregate demand that's been thrown at the economy.
This is interesting because the federal government, for good or for ill, would appear to be sheeting the blame home to global conditions and decisions by the Reserve Bank. And you've heard the talk that Philip Lowe is, you know, friendless, may not have his job renewed when his contract finishes. But what you're telling me is that we've forgotten this fundamental point, that we're actually still in this incredibly good position and that people who got mortgages, they got those mortgages at emergency low levels. Of course it was going to go up again. The only question was how much.
Yeah, and for many people, you've got to realise that house prices went up very great amount.
Because of the pandemic once again?
Because the interest rates were cut to the lowest ever in history, in Australian history. And now they've started to fall. But many of those houses are still higher in price than they were when those interest rates were cut down to, you know, close to zero. So
things are equalising to a certain extent.
Yeah. We're sort of getting the down cycle. What I actually think is going to happen is I think it's unusual to have this kind of down cycle in house prices for it to be sustained. And I think the reason it's happening is because we went through a period where we weren't importing immigrants, okay? Now, pretty soon, we're going to have 190,000 immigrants a year hitting that this jobs market and hitting that housing market.
Yes.
And I think when we get, you know, every one of those immigrants who comes into Australia and they're selected to come into Australia to fill particular jobs, as soon as they come here and they get that full-time job, they qualify for a housing mortgage. So they can buy a house. And then that takes up this excess supply of houses, which is allowing the price to fall. So what normally happens in a housing cycle in Australia when interest rates go up the way they have is that house prices don't really fall that much because you've got this next line of immigrants turning up to buy the house that somebody just wants to sell. So you have this extended period in Australia of flat housing prices where they hold their price in nominal, in dollar terms, okay? That's what happens in previous cycles. they fall a bit in real terms because inflation goes up. But you don't. The reason you haven't had this kind of big sell-off before is we went through that gap where we weren't importing new immigrants to fill job positions. And that's kind of how we got in this situation of getting 3.5% unemployment instead of 4.5% unemployment, which was probably one intention. But when all those immigrants start hitting the job market and qualifying for mortgages, that's going to generate a surge in demand and put a real flaw in these house prices. So I think, and that's, then we'll be back in a much more normal Australian housing cycle.
Michael Knox, economist from Morgans, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Steve.